The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Allison Schrager. Allison is an economist, journalist at Quartz, and co-founder of Lifecycle Finance Partners, a risk advisory firm. She led retirement product innovation at Dimensional Fund Advisors and consulted for international organizations, including the OECD and the IMF. She's also been a regular contributor to The Economist, Reuters, and Bloomberg Businessweek. She has a PhD in economics from Columbia University and currently teaches at New York University. And she has a new book. It's called An Economist Walks Into a Brothel. Allison Schrager, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We talk a lot about risk, both in the pedagogy of improvisation, but also in the professional craft of comedy. And the thing that we know is that the worst kind of risk is when you go in unpracticed, in all the nuance and shifting context that can make for a healthy risk or an unhealthy risk. And your book really begins with the premise that many people don't really understand what risk is. So why don't we start there? What is risk?
Well, risk is just an estimate of when you do something, all the different things that could possibly happen, because the future is always unknowable. But what risk is, at least in financial economics, is an estimate of everything you can imagine happening and how probable it is.
And you write in the book that, quote, if we avoid risk, our lives won't move forward. So we can avoid risk, but we risk stagnation.
Yeah, I mean, you can't totally avoid risk, but you could definitely, the more risk averse you are, the less payoff you're going to get. I mean, risk is how we move forward. I imagine, you said, especially in comedy, you take a lot of risks.
Yeah.
Or even decision to become a comedian is a risky one.
Yeah, it sure is.
The payoffs are having a job you love and being successful at it.
All right. So very provocative title. And I enjoy that the book sort of jumps off with this and then goes to a bunch of different places. But you visited the Moonlight Bunny Ranch, which was run by the late Dennis Hoff. What propelled you to study risk from the perspective of sex workers?
Well, I had this idea. You know, it's my background's in retirement finance, so not exactly the sexiest area of economics.
No.
But I had this idea. You know, I had a background as a journalist that, you know, I felt like no one really understood these fundamentals of financial theory, yet we kind of expect people to understand risk and take it so well. Yet, you know, finance is the study of risk, and it seemed like the lessons would be really helpful, in fact, or necessary to know in the modern economy. But I've always just loved, this is a little weird thing for an economist, is I just really love people and love storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this idea that, you know, I could use storytelling to make these ideas a little bit more exciting, interesting, and just resonate with people more. And, you know, weirdly, I already had this relationship with the Bunny Ranch because I'd done a story on them in the past. And when I was there, I just was really impressed with what good risk takers all the women I met were. And I don't think people expect that from them. So when I was thinking of different stories that I felt like could highlight and make risk a little bit more exciting, it just seemed like a natural fit.
And you said that you've never met a shrewder business person than Shelby Starr.
Yeah, well, maybe, some other women in the brothel are equal to her, but I can't say I've met a better one.
Yeah. So what was it that made her so shrewd? What's her story?
Well, yeah, they're just great business people. Like, I tell the story of how before she worked in the brothel, she was an exotic dancer. And she says to me, she's like, I was an exotic dancer or a stripper on the conference circuit. And I'm like, wait, there's a conference circuit for strippers? And she's like, no, well, I noticed when I was, she was also an executive by day and a stripper by night.
Mm-hmm.
She said she only kept like her day job as an executive because of the social shame with being in the sex industry, and she had young children.
Hmm.
But she noticed that she'd make more money when certain conferences were in town. So she figured out where all the conferences would be and built relationships with strip club owners all over the country so she could follow the most lucrative conferences all over the country. So, I mean, she's just clearly a very good businesswoman from the start. And when I first went to the Bunny Ranch, it was to learn negotiation skills. And I remember her sitting me down and teaching me how she approaches negotiation. And, I mean, I was just really wowed.
Hmm. We just interviewed Rich Karlgaard, who wrote a book called Late Bloomers, about how we sort of fetishize the youth and young, and a lot of people, you know, as they get older, actually become better intruder. And you write in this book, quote, the older workers' advanced people skills gave them an advantage when it comes to cultivating clients, meeting their needs, and making them feel safe and comfortable. And I thought that was interesting because I don't know that you would have thought that walking in the door.
No, I think everyone expects that the sex workers who earn the most are going to be like these, you know, 18-year-old, like, you know, model types. And they do well, but really they tend not to be the super high earners. The higher earners are able to have really good interpersonal skills because, sadly, most people go to brothels just because they're lonely and are looking for connection and companionship. Mm-hmm. And the older women tend to be a lot better at supplying that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So people always are surprised when I tell women in their 40s and they kind of joke about their days are gone. I'm like, oh, no. Your peak earning years is a sex worker. You're just hitting them.
Mm. All right. I actually posted, I was reading the book, and I posted on LinkedIn a quote from it. You wrote, quote, it sounds simple, but knowing what you want might be the hardest part of risk management. That sounds so simple, but I think it's fairly profound because I think this is, I see this, you talked about people who choose to be in comedy, you know, they have not considered the risks of that. Certainly social shame, but really more of, you know, nothing in your wallet for many, many
yeah.
years. So what is it about knowing what you want and how does that work into your studies of risk?
Well, I mean, you really need to set a clear goal because the foundation of any risk, you know, a lot of people I find just take risks without, you're really thinking through what they're doing. They're just like, I need a change. Something about my life isn't working. So they're like, I'm going to move to a new city or I'm going to quit my job. But they don't really think through like what it is. You take a risk because you want more.
Yeah.
You need to be really clear on what more is. So like, if you become a comedian, it's like, you know, what about it? Is it what you're looking for? Do you need the attention? Do you need the adulation? Does making people laugh make you feel good? Or do you just really love comedy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that can help you decide, you know, what that path is going to be. You know, if you really just need the attention adulation, then clearly that's one path. If you just love being around comedy, there's maybe other ways you can do that. And that sort of makes that whole risk process a lot easier to manage.
Yeah, that's something that's really, I think, changing about the job market, especially in the sort of entertainment field, which is when I was coming up, you kind of had to know you were an actor or you were a writer, you were a producer, or you were a director. And now it's really changed. Almost everyone is a hyphenate, which I actually think is actually a pretty good thing because it does require you then to be like, okay, here's what I know. I like to work with people who aren't assholes. So let's make sure that's whatever I'm doing, that's what I'm doing. And I think that is a new way to think about entering the job market that really wasn't the case, you know, a decade or two decades ago.
That's a great way to diversify your skills. It's another great risk management technique.
Yeah. So you have a story about this, right? I mean, you basically went into a field that was almost certainly going to lead you to academia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you found out you didn't want to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think I made a mistake a lot of us make it early in our careers. We were just sort of doing something because it sounds like a good idea. I mean, I did an economics PhD because I loved economics. So I didn't really think beyond that. I was like, I worship famous economists. I thought economics was just fascinating. I got into a good PhD program, and I didn't really give it any thought beyond it. And it was really hard when I got there. So I just kept working harder and harder, thinking, well, if I work harder at this thing that's hard, something amazing is going to happen. And then I started going to job interviews to be an economics professor, and I'm like, wait, I really don't want to be here. here. This is never what I've wanted. I don't, you know, it's a great job, but it's definitely, you know, living in a small town and being a professor was just not for me. So it was just sort of like, it seemed like this risk didn't pay off for a while because I just had no idea what to do. Because, you know, you sort of are on this track where this is what success means. And all of a sudden, this late in the game, redefining success, it kind of threw me off my game for a long time.
Yeah, I kind of lucked out because, you know, I had this long career at Second City, and I had the luck of meeting Heather Caruso, who was running the Center for Decision Research at the Booth School of Business. And we hatched this idea about combining our stuff and studying behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. And the guy who signed off on it, who we had to convince to do it, was Richard Thaler. So I like, right. So suddenly I'm like in these like wild conversations with Thaler, who I only sort of knew and then started reading Nudge, and of course he won the Nobel Prize. But it became, you talk about sort of being fascinated with economic models with regard to how they sort of impose on a chaotic world. And improvisation and our idea does the same thing, but as a practice. You need to sort of, with other people in a room, co-create through all the noise. And so I would never have thought I would be interested in economics, but because I don't know that I am, but I am curious about ideas and order as it relates to chaos and that sort of thing. So just sidebar, it was kind of interesting, I thought.
That's fascinating. Yeah, you know, because as an outsider looking at comedy, you would never know that sort of order in it. But all economics does, as I said, is provide value to different things and help people weigh trade-offs.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess it's the same thing.
Yeah. You do talk about the entertainment field in this book, and you essentially tie traffic to making movies. So I'm sure anyone listening is like, you cannot connect those dots, but you kind of do.
Yeah. So for that chapter, that's a chapter on risk measurement, which sounds even like this has nothing to do with anything. One, I think anyone in the entertainment business knows risk is really hard to measure. It's really hard to predict what movies are going to be successful. So risk measurement is trying to put a number and quantify what are the odds something's going to happen. And you can imagine with movies, this is just incredibly hard. And, you know, I tie it to, you know, just traveling to the airport, which is, you know, it tends to be a very divisive risk because everyone has a different view. Some people like to get their hours in advance. Some people like to get their 10 minutes before their flight takes off, and there's a lot we can reveal about risk, about how people feel about that. But I describe how, like, the risk measurement problem of getting to the airport, because, you know, the odds are, when you think about airport travel time, it probably takes between, I don't know, like 20 and 35 minutes, and you make your airport travel time decision based on that time span.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's possible you could get into, like, a horrible, there could be a horrible car accident that really makes it 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we call a tail case. Like, it's really unlikely. It's probable, but highly unlikely. So you don't leave the airport for 3 hours in advance in case there's a 200 car pileup. But it is a possibility. And that's what makes it somewhat easy to decide airport travel time. So you can calibrate based on your own risk taking because it's fairly predictable. There's a window in how long it takes. Maybe that window is a little bit larger if there's traffic or if there's rain, but it's fairly predictable. With movies, you don't have that predictability. We have what we call a skewed distribution, which is most movies lose money. And then from there, it's just this total crapshoot of anywhere between taking 10 minutes to get to the airport or 3 hours. That would be the equivalent of what movie producers are facing. And that's one reason why they tend to be very geared towards trends or action-adventure movies is because they get that little bit more certainty.
And they have this insane business model where they basically know that most of their movies are not going to make any money, so they make a lot of them so that the one or two that do basically pay for all the ones that don't.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons they make a lot of movies. We're like, who greenlit this? How did this happen?
Right.
Is because they said they don't. It's really hard to do risk management it's so hard to measure risk. They do the same thing in venture capital, which is why you sometimes look at these startups to get funds. You're like, why would that happen? Because venture capital firms follow a very similar strategy.
And one of the characters you highlight in this chapter is Ryan Kavanaugh, who co-founded Relativity Media in 2004. And this is a guy who basically said, I have an algorithm, I have a measurement tool that's going to help you invest in the right movies. And people listen to him at first, right?
Yeah, Yeah, and you know, there's reasons why movies are so hard to measure, and one of which is the data is just terrible. One, it's super skewed, and second, you know, what was true of the movie industry 5-10 years ago is not true at all now. So he tried to use, like, data from the past to effectively predict what movies in the future would do well. But the problem is, as I said, not only do you have this skew, which makes measurement really unreliable, but it's like the data changes so fast that any model will work for maybe a year or two before it will fall apart. Like, think about, like, DVDs. You know, like, 10 years ago, that was a serious source of revenue for movie studios. Now, it's like, who buys a DVD? No one. Mm-hmm. So it's completely dried up. You know, you have China coming in. You've got Rotten Tomatoes. So it's a particularly hard problem to measure because the data just keeps changing.
Yeah, and like, the world is changing all the time, and rarely we know that. And, you know, we're making all these decisions when things have completely changed. You have a great line, quote, "The past is a lousy way to predict the future." Especially in what we're talking about right now, these delivery systems, right? They're completely different. They've overhauled, or like touring musicians and the music industry and album sales. It is a completely different world. And actually, I loved the section where you talk about David Bowie being kind of ahead of the curve. Talk to us about that, because I don't think people, you know, people love Bowie. They know Bowie because of his very diverse career and his art and music and all that. But this guy was a smart businessman.
Yeah, it was his foresight's amazing.
Yeah.
So when he was young, like 18 or 19, you know, he got his first record deal. And, you know, when you sign a record deal, this is often true of any creative industry, where you sign a deal with a record company and they essentially own all your royalties going forward, and in exchange they give you an advance. And, you know, when you're young and looking to be discovered, this seems like a good deal, and it actually is, because most of the time you're not going to make it and you get to keep that money anyway and your royalties mm-hmm. are worthless. So what they do is they give you money up front, and then the odd person who does make it, those royalties are what funds this industry, and that's why musicians always seem to be going bankrupt. Well, they are also bad at managing money, but yeah. Not David Bowie. So when he was a young kid and he gets his deal, he was like, no, I really want to hold on to my royalties, which really is a bad risk mm-hmm. for... It seems like a crazy risk at the time. The odds are he wasn't going to become David Bowie. So he took off. But, you know, record company was like, great, you know, we get to give you less money. But then it turned out he was David Bowie and his royalties were worth a fortune.
Mm-hmm.
But then I guess fast forward in his late 40s, maybe early 50s, he was facing a very different problem. You know, he was older, he was thinking about estate planning. I think he had some tax liability. But most important, this was mid late 90s. So you had Napster. And he took one look at that, and he's like, I don't think these royalties are going to be worth as much as they used to, because I think this is going to really change the economics of music. So what he did is he securitized his royalties. He did it as they came up, they packaged them as a bond. And they were just about to re-release them, so it was good timing, where I think it was Prudential bought a security based on his royalties where they got, you know, several hundred million dollars or a couple million dollars a year for like 15 years. And they effectively got the payouts of his royalties, although he still technically owned it. It was like a mortgage-backed security. It's like someone buying a mortgage from you. It's like he sold his royalties for 10 or 15 years. And it was sort of like, it's interesting because it's almost like the opposite bet that he took all those years later.
Yeah.
But he knew because the industry had changed, he needed to make that change.
Yeah. Because I've read in interviews where he talked about the fact that this is changing. Copyright owning things is not going to be the thing it was before. So he shifted with the model as it was changing, as opposed to waiting and then being, you know, hurt by it.
Yeah, I mean, I said it's amazing at the foresight when he was 19 to know how much his royalties would be worth. He knew when. Like, I mean, at Napster, you think back then, we didn't know what that was going to mean, but he saw it.
Did you see, there was a study this week released that said that we are at our most creative, our creative minds are the best in our 20s and 50s.
Really?
Yeah, there was a study that was just went out, and I was sort of like, "That's interesting." And I haven't read it, so I don't know how, you know, high quality it is. But one mm-hmm. of the things I thought about that is you in the sort of youth area where you kind of can take more risks because you know you don't have kids, you might not have a big mortgage. Mm-hmm. That's a problem. And then when you get older, you know so much more that you can calculate your risks better. I don't know if that's the thing, but it was kind of an intriguing idea.
That's interesting. And yeah, you know, I mean, for all the crap people get for being, having all these biases and not being able to take risk, there's also a lot of evidence that people become better risk takers as they get older.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I mentioned behavioral science, and you go into that in the book because, you know, the number one thing that when I got exposed to this field and just made so much sense to me was the idea that for years and years we patterned things and built things and made decisions based on thinking that people operated as rational actors when, in fact, the opposite is true. We are not rational. And so you talk about poker, you talk about Kahneman and Tversky. It's a really eclectic look, but let's go into some of this stuff because, and I think the poker point is kind of interesting because you highlight Phil Hellmuth, who by all means should be a terrible poker player because he's so emotional. But he really taught himself to control that and then became world class.
Yeah, so he is known for throwing these tantrums, for having no self-control. But he's also remarkably what they call patient poker player, and that he only pays 12% of his hands, which is way less than everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
He has this ability when he's playing poker to sort of be very rational and not get emotional. I mean, he explodes once the game's over. And he talks about how over the years, how much he's had to hone this skill. He even said when he was young and first starting out, he was passed out from the emotional exhaustion of trying to keep his emotions in check. But now he has all these like techniques, which involve things like not ever going in with too much of his own money at stake. He has other people take a stake in his winnings. He cuts other side deals with the other players to make sure that he always gets some piece of the final winning. And just practice and education, and which help him do better framing, has helped him only play 12% of times, which is much lower and shocking considering how he seemed so out of control all the other times.
It was interesting. You mentioned that about this idea of using other people's money as being a way that allows you to sort of, you know, risk more or better. And that is a thing that is true in a variety of fields. I mean, very much old school Broadway was all, you know, get the checks together. And the guy who's doing all this, he doesn't have any money in this thing at all. But it gives them a kind of freedom to go out there and risk the fact that they might have a giant, huge hit that he will win at. And everyone else ends up winning, too. Most of them don't. Like in poker, you know, most of those shows don't go anywhere.
Yeah, and I mean, what it helps him do is, you know, there's this problem, which is, instead of coming from Kahneman Tversky, which is that, you know, we have loss aversion, which is when we're down, we tend to get desperate. But if it's not your money at stake, he doesn't get as desperate.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that, again, is one of the reasons why in entertainment, it's good to get a lot of other investors involved. That way you get a little bit less desperate and can walk away from something just not working.
I thought the other thing that was fascinating here is the idea that you need to avoid overconfidence. Comes up constantly in like my work life, and I imagine in your life too, and in my life. It's just the what a liability immense confidence can be in people, making them think they know everything, and in reality, they don't normally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that's always, you know, certainly with risk taking, especially, is people always tend to overestimate how likely something is to happen. Like, they think they have certainty when they don't. Like, I think I interviewed Sam Antar, the mastermind behind the Crazy Eddie electronics scheme.
Yes.
And this is crazy. They had this business. It's really, I don't know if it was big in Chicago, but in the Northeast, these ads were just everywhere.
Yeah.
People still remember them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was like 35 years ago. And they, him and his family had an electronics business where they were skimming taxes. So it was an illegal business from day one. But they, you know, were only making like several $1 million doing it. So they had this idea. They were going to take this company public, like actually sell shares on the stock market of a criminal enterprise. And I'm being like, that is insane. Like, didn't you think you were going to get caught? And to this day, he's like, no. You know, we just, you know, we thought we were managing our risk. I'm like, that was a really bad decision. That is just to talk about overconfidence, to think that you can sell shares of a criminal enterprise of the stock market and to have this go and have it end well.
Yeah. I remember we had on Dacre Keltner, who's a Berkeley professor who did the studies around people who break laws. He set up a four-way stop that they put cameras on in Berkeley, and which cars were running the stop sign. And they were all the expensive cars. And the reason that the people who weren't running the stop line stop signs, who were in poor cars, is they couldn't afford to. And the idea, the idea that he draws out is people with lower status, poor people, they see more truth than people with higher status and more money and more privilege.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So another thing that I thought was a real outlier kind of conversation is, like, you dug into, like, the paparazzi world with regard to risk, which, like, I hate those people, or I think I hate those people. And I wonder if that was your thing going in as well.
Curious. I mean, they were a little mean when I first met them, so that made me dislike them more. But as I got to know them, you know, everyone's just doing their job. And, you know, I got to say, celebrities have been very good at cultivating a narrative that they're hounded by these horrible people. When really, you know, often they're in on this. And in fact, at least certainly when they're coming up in their career, often, you know, a lot of their tips are coming from the celebrities themselves. But, you know, and you have these people, again, a lot of them are immigrants just trying to make a buck, and it is a hard, hard business. They face so much risk, and the industry is really imploding on them and getting much, much harder. So, you know, they have to, you know, do what they can. And I just saw that, I think it was Gigi Hadid is being sued by a paparazzo because she used one of his images on her Instagram. So he's suing her because it's his picture.
Wow.
And, oh, it was just this odd turn of events. This is happened a couple times, and I saw she put out this, like, she lived her life being hounded by the paparazzi, which is true. You know, I got to know them because they're always camped outside her apartment, and it's sort of near where I live. But on the other hand, she often usually does tip them off when she's going to be there. So, you know, there's a more of a symbiotic relationship between celebrities and paparazzi than I think a lot of people realize.
And in this chapter, you get into this idea of two different kinds of risk, idiosyncratic risk and systematic risk. And both are at play over the course of this, the sort of where paparazzi have gone because the system has changed, right?
Yeah. So idiosyncratic risk is like the risk in finance that individual stock will fall, like Facebook, you know, if they fire Mark Zuckerberg. I don't know if they can, but if they did, that would affect the stock price of Facebook and probably nothing else. That's idiosyncratic to Facebook. And you can totally eliminate that risk by diversifying. So if you own an index fund, you won't even notice what happens to Facebook. Now, paparazzi face a lot of that, too, because you can imagine, like, the odds of getting that money shot are so random. Like, you're going about your day, you're waiting for Gigi, and then, you know, some celebrity could walk by in the middle of an affair, and that could just be a complete life changer. Or you could spend the day stalking a celebrity like I did with them a couple times, and, you know, you don't even see them. So it's just, or maybe you get a good tip and someone else doesn't. So what they do is they diversify the same way we do in markets, which is they form these alliances of other paparazzi and they share tips, sometimes royalties. It depends on the arrangement. But the problem is they're always doomed to have to bear this risk because these alliances are very fragile because you always have an incentive to cheat because you get more money for an exclusive. So they're always reforming and falling apart and they all kind of hate each other because they all have like very bitter histories. But that's not even the worst thing. The worst thing is systematic risk, which is like the risk that the entire stock market would crash like it did in 2008. And so they also have to deal with this now because the celebrity photography business is a lot more cyclical than you would think it is.
Mm-hmm.
During the like Britney Spears, Lindsay Lohan heyday, you know, back when Britney Spears was like shaving her head. I mean, these were the golden years for the paparazzi. They even call it the gold rush era. And that is its technical term. And they would get, you know, $15,000, $20,000 for what they call a just like us photo, which is a picture of a celebrity, you know, doing something normal. But then the recession came and the market just crashed, especially with online media. And now they'll get $5 or $10 for that same picture.
Hmm.
And just like systematic risk in markets, that risk is a lot harder to manage. Like you have to go and find these very obscure, expensive assets that can, you know, not move with the whole market. And now that's what they're stuck doing, too. And it makes the business a lot harder to make money in.
All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to share a yes and story, which is always how we end the podcast with all our guests. But before we do that, there's one more person who you feature in the book that I'd like to talk about, and that's Cat Cole, who really personified someone who, you know, like, handles risk beautifully. And she had a really unusual start, right? I mean, was that this first job at Hooters?
Yeah, so she's this business executive who worked her way up as a waitress at Hooters. You know, college dropout, because she's such a good Hooters waitress. But what's amazing about her is, you know, even when you talk to her, she's so certain of what she wants, and she just goes after it. So this is, like we were saying before, about the best way to manage risk is to know what you're taking a risk for. She never just takes a risk blindly. She was very clear. Like, even when she dropped out of college to become a Hooters waitress, she was like, I know, I have a sense of where this could go, and it's where I want to be. And, you know, I'm not sure college can get me there, but I know this will be a more direct route to it. And as I said, by the time she was 30, she was like this high-flying private equity executive, and she's only gone up from there.
Yeah. The Cinnabon story is kind of funny because she ran Cinnabon, right, for a period of time?
Yeah.
They had this huge problem, right, because the trends are not to eat that kind of food.
Yeah, so this was, I think, like around like 2010. And so every other fast food restaurant was trying to come up with like healthful options, like anyone goes to McDonald's for a salad. And so Cinnabon, you know, when she started, everyone's like, well, I guess we need a healthy Cinnabon. And so they were coming up with this stuff, and it just tasted awful.
Terrible.
And she, I mean, they were losing sales because they were, you know, selling a product that was like 900 calories. So, but she had the idea of like, why don't we just make it smaller? That way it still tastes delicious, and it's still our brand that we're this wonderful indulgence, but it will mean we can get more people. And initially, it's, I mean, that sounds so obvious, but it was actually a big risk at the time because, you know, if you're selling that smaller product, you have to charge less. And initially the franchise owners were worried that they, by charging less, they would, you know, have less revenue. But in the end, she's like, no, you'll get more customers. And she was right.
Wow, that's amazing. All right. So we always ask our guests at the end of the podcast to share a yes and story. So an improvisation, you can't say no when you're groups of people making something out of nothing. And you can't stop at saying yes. The only way you can do this is by saying yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you've got a yes and story from your life or work for us.
Yeah, absolutely. It was definitely when the Bunny Ranch called me and invited me to the brothel.
All right. Tell how that call went.
Well, I get this call because I'd written some story about an online brothel in New York where they were doing some sort of risk management, and I get this call from the Bunny Ranch, and they're like, well, if you're going to write about brothels, you should be writing about us. And I was like, well, I don't write about brothels. Why? This is a weird call, but I was like, but, you know, I'm going to indulge this. Yes, and tell me about your business. And they said, this is the start of my relationship with them. And they said, well, we, all the women are independent contractors. We don't accept prices. So every transaction is negotiated. And I was like, well, wait, are you telling me that you got women who are like 20 years old, negotiating for tens of thousands of dollars with men in their 60s? And they're like, oh yeah, happens all the time. And in fact, when they come here, they often don't know how to negotiate well or don't understand their values. So we have a negotiation training program. And that's when I was like, yes, I will take this invitation. I will come.
That is awesome. I love it. And it led to a great book, which is called An Economist Walks into a Brothel. Allison Schrager, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.